Welcome back to the Introduction to Modern Cryptography lecture. What did we do last week? We looked at message authentication codes as the core building block. I hope this microphone thing works. As the core building block that we use for authenticating anything in symmetric cryptography. And this building block was then, at the end of last week's lecture, used to build authenticated encryption with associated data, AEAD. Today we start with some final remarks on AEAD. We just look at the secure generic constructions of MEC, then encrypt again. And we will then quickly recap what did we see so far in the lecture. We will basically end the chapter of symmetric cryptography. Do you have a question? Okay, thank you. We will then basically have a recap of symmetric encryption or symmetric cryptography to quickly summarize what did we see so far. And we will then have a quick outlook what we will see when we look at asymmetric cryptography. And the first part, the first chunk, the first topic in asymmetric cryptography that we will look at will be digital signatures. So, final remarks on AEAD. We had this, the encrypt and MEC construction in the lecture at the end of last week already. The idea was basically that we have a symmetric encryption scheme and we have a message authentication code. Those are given. And then we built an authenticated encryption scheme as follows. The gen algorithm samples or generates a key for the encryption. It generates a key for the MEC, and then the final authenticated encryption key is just the composition of those two keys. The encryption algorithm takes as input key, message, and associated data. It passes the key by identifying its two chunks, the encryption key and the MEC key. Then it first encrypts the message, taking the encryption key, and the resulting ciphertext is then authenticated together with the associated data string using the message authentication code. And then the final ciphertext is the concatenation of the encryption ciphertext and the MEC tag. The decryption splits the key into its two components. It splits the ciphertext into its two components. Then first it verifies whether the message authentication code is good. So it verifies whether the tag was authentic. If it was not, then it will reject the ciphertext, and otherwise it will just decrypt with the symmetric encryption scheme, the ciphertext component of the full AEAD ciphertext. The final statement that I wanted to make at the... Yes, please.
Where does the concatenation occur on your...
So, basically was hiding how the concatenation works precisely. The concatenation is here. So the output of the authenticated encryption scheme is just a ciphertext. Yes. And this ciphertext consists of two components. And the two components are the encryption ciphertext and the tag. And one way to do that would be to concatenate them. But the problem is that if you just concatenate them, then it will be hard to identify the tag. And so what you would want to do is you would use some encoding. And encoding is a non-cryptographic question, but it is a practically relevant question. And I believe this is the actual question that you have. So how would we want to encode that? And there are dozens of encoding schemes. I would need to prepare the best encoding, the most efficient encoding schemes that would be relevant here, but there needs to be some kind of encoding to split or to, first of all, combine ciphertext and tag, and then also split them again when I receive and decrypt, want to decrypt them.
Why don't you merge on two values? Why don't you keep them separate? I mean, you can merge on the C and the...
Yes. But yes, of course. The idea is then still that if you use an authenticated encryption scheme in some higher level, more complex protocol, then the only thing that this higher level protocol wants to do is it wants to take a ciphertext from the encryption side that consists of two components that are still separate but somehow encoded together. And I, as the higher level construction, don't care how this encoding works. I just want to use the ciphertext on the encryption side, take it, and feed it to the receiver such that decryption works. So yes, those two things will stay somewhat separate, but they will be combined in some form of combined ciphertext with an encoding. Does this satisfy you slightly? Not really. We will see. I don't plan to say anything more about that. So if we want to talk about encoding now, we have to talk about it now. We won't talk about it later. The thing that I wanted to say was the theorem statement. So the theorem is that the generic encrypt then MEC construction yields a secure authenticated encryption scheme with associated data. More precisely, for every adversary ACPA, against game I in D, CPA for the authenticated encryption scheme, there exists an adversary B, SE, such that the advantage of an attacker against this AEAD scheme in the IND CPA game of the adversary in this CPA game is less equal than the advantage of an attacker breaking the symmetric encryption scheme in the IND CPA game. And for every adversary A SUF against game SUF CMA with the associated encryption scheme, authenticated encryption scheme, there exists an adversary BMAC such that the advantage of of an attacker breaking the AEAD scheme in the SUFCMA game. Is less equal the advantage of an attacker breaking the MAC scheme in the SUFCMA game. And the reduction isn't super complicated. But we will talk about the reduction in the exercise, I guess, next week.
Is there a formal difference when you write for the advantage to, because it's lowercase letters for the INDCPA, or is this just?
Stylistic choice that I take from the academic literature. So you can write it the way you want to. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's just a habit. Yeah. No. It's just a habit. You will oftentimes actually see that these advantage terms are underspecified in the literature. And I try to add all relevant information to these advantage terms. I think the major problem is if you write something like SUFCMA in capital letters in LaTeX, you will have super long advantage terms, which like you will have to break the line and stuff like that, and for that reason this is just but academic literature writing style. Okay, this was about the generic construction of authenticated encryption using message authentication code and standard symmetric encryption, where each of these components provides the security guarantees that we expect from them. The encryption scheme offers confidentiality, and the message authentication codes offers authenticity and integrity. There are specific constructions that slightly deviate from that or are standardized and relevant in practice. So the first to name is the Galois counter mode, GCM, then CCM and Chachapoli 1305. And you can read about those in depth in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 163 and following. What I wanted to say about them is that they are specialized schemes. With at least strong or partially stronger efficiency . They are all standardized, and some of them offer stronger guarantees than only strong unforgeability and INDCPA security. We will talk about special features or security guarantees in a couple of seconds after that. So GCM is basically a specialized counter mode with parallel GMAC. It's standardized by NIST. As SP800-38D. And in RFC 4106, and the advantage of having a counter mode that in parallel computes the MAC is that in contrast to the generic encrypt then MAC construction, you don't need to first compute the entire ciphertext and then authenticate the ciphertext after that, but you can compute the ciphertext and the tag component simultaneously. So the problem of the generic construction is that you basically have to process something in the length of the message twice, or something that is that takes as much time as processing something that processes the message basically twice. So with parallel GMAC computation, you can reduce the overhead of computing the MAC. But important to say is that this Galois counter mode works in specific structures. I've just mentioned the GMAC last year when we talked about MAC, so this is also a specialized message authentication code construction. We don't go into the details here, but if you're interested in that, you can take a look at the Katz-Lindell book. The CCM construction is basically MAC then encrypt. With counter mode and CBC MAC specified in RFC 3610. And I have talked about this last week. So the only generically secure construction of MACing and encrypting is to first encrypt and then MAC. And this just says something about if you don't know which encryption scheme and which message authentication code you're combining, the only thing that you know about them is that each of them provides the properties that we want from them. Then first encrypting and then MACing is always secure. But if you want to do something slightly smarter and you know which message authentication code and you know which encryption scheme you're combining, then you also can use different types of combinations. For example, MAC then encrypt is just insecure if you can artificially choose a bad encryption scheme or a bad message authentication code, which both still offer strong unforgeability or INDCPA security, but in the combination they do something badly. In the combination in which you know what you're doing, then you can prove still that some certain constructions of MAC then encrypt are secure. So the statement that I want to write down here is that this is not secure in general. But here in this particular case, it is secure. The third construction is Chachapoli 1305. And this is a special stream cipher. With a special MAC. I already said something about the rough idea of Poly 1305, or what that it is based on special message authentication code construction concepts. The main takeaway that you can get here is that it is highly efficient and the other somewhat high level takeaway is that this entire authenticated encryption scheme is called the so-called Bernstein cipher. And it is specified in RFC 8439. What is relevant about Bernstein and Bernstein cipher is maybe some of you have heard of Daniel Bernstein. Daniel Bernstein is a very smart cryptographer, but he's a very controversial person. So in art, you would probably sometimes speak about splitting the artist from their work or from their art. Bernstein is very, very good at doing things, but due to his way of interacting with others, there have been big controversies in the academic community. And this then sometimes in practice leads to a community that could be considered Bernstein believers and those who don't want to work with Bernstein anymore. And such polarization of the community then leads to some people always only using Bernstein products. So he's not only someone who is able to work in symmetric cryptography, but he also came up with a couple of elliptic curves, for example, for Diffie-Hellman stuff. He also works on post-quantum secure cryptography. So he's really, really smart, but yeah. I think that's everything that I wanted to say on tape. Okay, special features and problems. So one thing that our definition of what authenticated encryption is not covered is so-called key committing encryption. What that means is that an AAD scheme offers key committing if ciphertexts are only accepted by or with the single correct key. So the attacker scenario is basically that an attacker knows some key K1, and this attacker A creates a ciphertext C that is valid for two different keys. For key one and key two that is different from key one. And this property that this is hard to achieve. So consider an attacker. This attacker shares one key with Alice and another key with Bob. And then this attacker produces a ciphertext that is valid for both of these keys. Obviously, it will decrypt to two different messages, but it will probably be accepted by both of these users. Or consider a messaging protocol where you continuously update your symmetric keys, and then the attacker is basically Alice, and Alice sends a ciphertext or produces a ciphertext that is valid for the one key, and the ciphertext is also valid for another key. As long as the attacker knows both keys, this property is of course not covered by strong unforgeability, because in strong unforgeability, our attacker does not have a clue about the key. So this property that it is hard to produce ciphertext valid for two keys is not covered or not captured by strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks. The reason that key committing encryption became relevant was that in Facebook, when you send direct messages, these messages are end-to-end encrypted. And additionally, when Alice sends a message to Bob, the Facebook server will shortly look at the ciphertext, attach some committing information to the ciphertext, and then the receiver receives the ciphertext. And at some point, maybe Bob decrypts the ciphertext, sees there was some abusive content in that ciphertext, and wants to report that ciphertext back to Facebook and say, hey, Facebook, look at this ciphertext. This was the message in there. And the problem is that if you don't have key committing encryption, there can be problems with this so-called message franking or abuse reports protocol. So if you have key committing encryption, then you are sure. So basically what Alice could have said was that, okay, after she was reported for sending abusive stuff, she could have said, no, I didn't send this ciphertext under key K1, where this abusive message was the result. I was sending it with key K2. And Bob just tried to frame my message as abusive by checking if all of my ciphertexts become abusive if I was using K1. So basically, if you don't use key committing encryption, you can always fake to have sent some different content in a message by saying, no, I was never using K1. K2 was the key that I was using. This is a somewhat artificial example, but if you want to prove that you commit to the message that you're sending, then key commitment is one of the things that you would like to have. The second problem that causes security or weaknesses in authenticated encryption schemes is nonce or initialization vector reuse. So many encryption schemes become insecure once the nonce, which stands for number used once, respectively the initialization vector is repeated. Obviously, if I reuse the same nonce and I reuse the same message, then my encryption scheme will tell me, or the ciphertext will tell me, that I used the same message for encryption, because the ciphertext will be the same. We have a deterministic encryption algorithm, we use the same nonce, we use the same message, then I know that from the outside as an observer, then I know that this message was encrypted twice. But beyond that, there are more problems for many encryption schemes. In particular, authentication for the Galois counter mode is broken once the IV or nonce is repeated. This was brought up and identified by Ferguson at a NIST workshop in 2005. For this reason, there is an alternative or a slightly modified version of the Galois counter mode, and this is the so-called GCMSIV, which is specified in RFC 8452. And this modified version only reveals that if two ciphertexts C1, C2 with same initialization vector IEV1 and IEV2 and same encrypted message M1 equals M2, encrypt the same message. And this is, as I just said before, inevitable. Okay, so nonce and IV reuse can be a problem. There are certain constructions like GCM in plain that become insecure once nonce is repeated. And there are alternatives like GCMSIV that solve this problem, at least for GCM. There are further properties that one could want for authenticated encryption beyond strong unforgeability and IND CPA security. So now I think I have to solve this microphone scarf situation first. This wasn't too loud. Okay. All right. Then with that, I basically end the chapter of symmetric encryption, and we now move to asymmetric cryptography. So far, we had users Alice, Bob, Charlie, and many other users. And whenever they had their cryptographic algorithms used, algorithm 1, algorithm 2 or algorithm 3, and they exchange ciphertexts or texts. Then we always assumed that somewhere there is something that gives them symmetric key material. At the very beginning of our lecture, we had key derivation functions that give Alice and Bob and Charlie the option to derive key material from low entropy inputs that are composed together. But even these passwords, they have to be exchanged somehow. So one option is to have a shared password. And a key derivation function. One option is to have public key encryption. Or something that we call a key exchange. But key exchange and public key encryption, they cannot be built from symmetric cryptography. There is a fundamental proof by Russell Impagliazzo and, I don't know the first name, Rudick. They prove that key exchange and thereby also public key encryption cannot be built from one-way functions. Okay, so we would like to build something like public key encryption, like key exchange. And we would like to also build similar ideas for any type of asymmetric cryptography that provide the guarantees that we have seen for symmetric cryptography. So let's summarize what we have seen so far. What are the functionalities and security goals that we have seen so far? Functionalities and security goals that we have seen so far. So in the symmetric world, we have seen pseudorandom generators and pseudorandom functions. And the basic idea of this is that we want to produce more keys. In the asymmetric world, we will see key encapsulation mechanisms. That help us building public key encryption, key exchange, and so on, and thereby basically producing and exchanging keys. The second task that we fulfilled was transmitting messages. And when we wanted to transmit messages, we wanted to achieve two security goals. The first one is confidentiality. And for this, we had symmetric encryption. And the asymmetric variant of that is called public key encryption. And we wanted to achieve authenticity. And for this, we had message authentication codes and AEAD, which is just a stronger variant of symmetric encryption that also provides authenticity. And in the asymmetric world, we will have signatures. And we start with signatures today. Our plan is to continue with public key encryption after that. Because that's the somewhat traditional way of looking at asymmetric form of establishing key material. But the interesting part is today, key encapsulation mechanisms are the fundamental building block with which we build public key encryption. Since the most traditional public key encryption scheme, or the most traditional public key encryption schemes don't need this split between establishing key material and then encrypting the message, we will, however, first start with public key encryption, and then after that, understand the abstraction layer with key encapsulation mechanisms. So, today we start with digital signatures. The idea of digital signatures are just the same idea as message authentication codes, just that we have asymmetric key material now. So we have Alice, and we have Bob. But we maybe have more users like Charlie and Dave and everybody else. And when Alice starts trying to use digital signatures, she will generate a key pair of a signing key and a verification key using her gen algorithm, and then she will distribute her verification key to everybody who wants to use it at some point. And then at some point, Alice wants to send a message to Bob. And she wants to protect that message such that using the verification key, Bob can check whether the message was actually sent that way from Alice. For this, Alice produces the signature, which is a small sigma, using algorithm sign with her secret key, with her secret signing key, and the message. And Bob can use the verification key with the corresponding verify algorithm with the corresponding verification key, the message, and the signature, which either outputs 0 or 1, depending on whether the verification was successful or not. Okay, there is not much new information here, so we will just directly start with a formal specification of the syntax. We have a gen algorithm that on input of nothing probabilistically produces a signing key and a verification key. We have the sign algorithm that on input of a signing key and an element of the message space probabilistically produces a signature. And the verification algorithm that takes the public verification key a message and a signature and deterministically outputs 0 or 1. Okay. So far, this was so simple that it didn't make sense to ask a question. We now reached the level of questions where it's not embarrassing to give an answer to. So what's the correctness definition for such a concept of signatures? Thank you very much. For all messages in the message space, and all signing key verification key pairs produced by the gen algorithm. Very good. So, security. How do we think a good notion of security could look like for signature schemes? Do we have a concept that could be related to that that we have seen before? What could be a definition of security for signatures? What do we want from signatures? Yeah.
They should be unforgeable.
This is the way that we define things for message authentication codes. We want that it should be hard for an attacker to come up with a signature that verifies with the verification key unless the signature has been produced by the user. So what could be a definition that covers unforgeability? Is the question too simple? I'll just write it down. So we have seen strong or normal unforgeability under chosen message attacks for MEX, and now we define them for signatures. So how would that game look like? What are the oracles? What is the adversary called with? What happens? It's not necessary that you entirely know what strong unforgeability looked for Max. It's probably more important that you understand what we would like or how we would like to model a realistic attacker, what type of capabilities we would get that attacker, how we express our security goal, what are realistic capabilities that we would give to an attacker. Yes, please.
The attacker can sign as
So we give the attacker a signing oracle, is that correct?
Yes.
What's the input? So if the attacker has a signing key, the attacker can do that themselves. We don't have to have an oracle for that. The attacker knows the algorithm.
Okay, no, then the input is only messages.
Yes. Perfect. Okay, what else would we like to give to the attacker? Yes, please. A verification oracle, but in principle, the attacker can do verifications themselves. Verification keys are public, but so if we do signing here, so let's do some signing here. What's the signing key? And what we do here? So what's the simplest form of modeling a victim?
Having a fixed key pair, so a fixed signing key for the signing oracle.
So we have a signing key and a verification key. We generate that at the beginning of the game. And we share that verification key with the attacker because that's realistic. That's what we think signatures should look like. We want that unforgeability holds even if the verification key is known, because the verification key should be distributed with many users, probably with all users. We just want to assume that all of these properties hold if the verification key is public. Okay, now, how would a successful attack look like? Mm-hmm. That's a very strong version. Yes, that's a very strong version, but so it's a good point, and it's good to discuss this for a second. If we think about both message authentication codes or symmetric encryption, or also later other types of primitives, when the attacker comes up with a secret key, independent of whether it's a symmetric key or an asymmetric key component, then of course the attacker can break all the other properties. But whenever we try to define security, we would like to define security with respect to the thing that gives us functionality. And the functionality, or the core part here, is the message. For encryption, it's also the message. For max, it's the message. For pseudorandom functions, it's the output key. For pseudorandom generators, it's the output key. So the thing that users actually use, or upper layer protocols use, this is the thing that is the target of the attacker and for which we would like to specify which properties it has. And so the secret key here is just the technicality. It's something that is used for signing, but it's nothing that the higher level protocol really wants to use. So what's the thing that a higher level protocol would like to use of signatures? Yes, please. A message and a signature. So, what are the conditions for the attacker to be successful? Yes, please. Okay, so we do that. We have some set Q in which we trace our message eyes and Q eyes. Yes? Then what is the condition of a successful attack? Yes.
It is not in the set that we memorized, and it is valid by the verification algorithm.
So, if M star sigma star is not in set Q, then we continue here. And then what was the second property? If verify with the verification key, this message and the signature equals one, then we stop the game with one. So this is strong unforgeability. Does anybody remember what standard unforgeability, existential unforgeability looked like? You can also say the intuition. So what is the intuitive goal? What is the intuitive goal of strong unforgeability, and what is the difference to standard unforgeability?
So yeah. I think for strong unforgeability, we want protected from the exact pair of M and sigma.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't have to be the case just for unforgeability.
So exactly. Strong unforgeability requires that the signature does not only protect the message, but it protects both the message and the signature. So as soon as an attacker is capable of either slightly modifying the message or slightly modifying the signature, then this is considered a forgery. Existential unforgeability requires only that the message is protected. So even if the attacker sees a message and a signature, and it produces a second signature that is still valid, by maybe slightly modifying the signature, then this is not considered an attack. So an unforgeable, just existential unforgeable signature scheme could always be attached, so the signature could always be attached with other bits or something. We can just ignore these bits at the end, because modifying the signature will not break the unforgeability of messages. But for strong unforgeability, this is not permitted. It's somehow intuitively not too far away from the idea of CCA security, which is super wrong in a formal sense. But in an informal sense, we talked in the exercise today about ways to prove that CPA security does not imply CCA security. Okay, so just writing it down. If there exists no signature such that message and message star and sigma prime is in Q, then we continue with the subsequent conditions. So just to fill out some formal information, the security definition that we require here is strong unforgeability under chosen message attacks S U F C M A, and the difference between U F and S U F is that U F protects that messages cannot be modified. And SUF protects that neither messages nor signatures can be modified. The advantage of these, of an attacker breaking either of these two games, is defined as the probability that this game for some signature scheme and adversary A outputs 1. A remaining problem that signatures do not solve for us is the following. We have user Alice and user Bob. And at some point, they want to use their signature scheme to send a message and a signature. But initially, Alice would like to share her verification key. And if Alice and Bob do not have any root source or source of initial trust relation, then of course an attacker sitting on the wire can modify her verification key. And then we basically didn't win anything. So what are possible solutions for the key distribution problem? Any ideas? What are solutions for distributing key material? How do we solve the problem that we have to distribute key material first? Yes, please. Public key infrastructure. Thank you very much. That's the first item on my list here. Public key infrastructure. APKI. The idea is, the idea of a PKI is that we have a chain of signatures to a root of trust. So typically in our browser or in our phone or laptop, something like that, we have a couple of roots of trust, a couple of verification keys that are just shipped with the hardware, with the software. So we just trust everything that is stored on our laptop already. And then from these roots of trust, we have signatures that prove to the lower layers, basically with some trust hierarchy or trust tree, such that, I don't know, my own website also is trusted by your browser. Okay, what else do we have to distribute key material authentically? Solutions from practice. What do we have? Yes, please. So there are two things that could be covered by, yeah. So one thing that is pretty old and not really used in practice anymore is the so-called web of trust. Does anybody know what the web of trust is? The web of trust is the idea that every user that wants to be sure that everybody else knows their verification key will share that verification key with all friends. And then there were these so-called key signing parties where hundreds or dozens of people sit together and they sit together in a room and everybody, one after another, reads out the hash of their verification key. And so everybody was able to just basically check whether the thing that they had stored on their laptop was correct. So if you, for example, go to the Chaos Computer Congress, you will probably see still that there are a couple of people who do these key signing parties. This is the idea of the web of trust. So you basically have pairwise. And that's the first step. So you just first of all read out the your hashes of verification keys, and then the second step is that you actually sign with your signature key the verification keys of others. And so basically, if you trust someone, then somebody else is new to your network, but you already have a signature from someone you trust, then you know that there is basically a mutual trust relationship. And the larger this gets, the more of a network this becomes. This is the idea. So you have pairwise signing, which is basically a reputation-based system via friends. What else do we have? What else do we have? Trivial trust on first use. One example of trust on first use is SSH. So if you connect to your SSH server, the SSH server will ask you, is this fingerprint okay? You just enter yes into your whatever console. And after that, whenever something is changed, you trust it on first use, and you hope that on the first use you didn't have a man-in-the-middle attack, and after that you will detect man-in-the-middle attacks. So you basically hope that initial contact was not attacked. Then you have manual key verification. A super easy example is that you typically pairwise scan QR codes of your friends . You can do that in WhatsApp, you can do that in Signal, you can do that in other applications where you basically just check, is the same thing stored on the other device? It's a more advanced version of the web of trust. And the final solution, does anybody know how how WhatsApp today changed their form of trusting that there was no attack in the key distribution, even if you don't use QR code scanning. Does anybody know that? Or there have been badly organized public key infrastructure routes of trust that signed certificates and then distributed those certificates only to few users, which basically means that doing that, you can basically implement man-in-the-middle attacks. Because if your root of trust only signs a certificate that can be used during an attack, this is bad. What is the thing that is used to check that every verification key, every certificate that is ever signed on the internet is stored and basically audited or observed, watched, and logged? It's mandatory. So if you want to use a website on Chrome and you use HTTPS and you don't use that, I'm pretty sure that Chrome doesn't show you the website anymore. The idea is key transparency, or called key transparency. Has anybody ever heard of key transparency? There is something that needs to be taught to you. Key transparency is basically that we decentrally lock all keys that are ever shipped and published. So you lock keys decentrally, and then you basically have a compact hash value of all the keys that have ever been shipped. And then, first of all, you have this compact verifier that tells you what has been shipped ever. And you also, from the one who is giving you the key material, you get basically a proof that the key material that you received is consistent with the current status of all key material ever shipped. This is done in WhatsApp. So in WhatsApp, if you receive a public key of somebody else, you can check if this public key is consistent with all the public keys ever published on WhatsApp. And you, as the sender of the public key, you can also check if your public key is correctly incorporated in the entire log of all public keys. And due to that, you see that as soon as there's public key shipped inconsistently, you see that there is an attack ongoing, or at least something was inconsistent. So you detect inconsistencies. Okay. The last thing that I would like to talk about today is the Lamport signature scheme. We will talk about other signature schemes in the next couple of days or weeks. But we will start with the Lamport signature scheme because it teaches us many interesting aspects a bit about how to build signature schemes, but also that you can actually build them from very primitive assumptions. And for this, we briefly introduce the building block, the main and the only building block for Lamport signatures. And this building block is a one-way function. We talked about one-way functions before because they are the most fundamental assumption that we use when talking about pseudorandom functions, pseudorandom generators, and so on and so forth. And the idea is super simple. We have a function that takes some input and produces some output, and the security guarantee that we want from one-way functions is that if the challenger samples an input element, computes the one-way function on input of that input element, provides the attacker with that output, then it should be hard for the attacker to come up with some input such that if the one-way function on input of that input produces the output, the attacker wins. The advantage for an attacker in breaking a one-way function is just the probability that the one-way game on that function for adversary A outputs 1. And the candidate constructions that we can think of when we talk about one-way functions are hash functions, pseudorandom generators, symmetric encryption, pseudorandom functions, and so on. But also something that we will talk about in the next couple of weeks, like the discrete logarithm. Where g to the x is y. And there are, of course, many other examples, but this was what I wanted to tell you about one-way functions. So this is the main building block of Lampert signatures. So, the easiest way to explain how the Lampert signature scheme works like is to describe its secret key, verification key, and the signature. So the signing key consists of multiple input values of a one-way function, more concretely, 2L inputs, where every input x, I, j is just sampled from the input space of the one-way function. So if our one-way function is just the hash function, then all of these values here, x1, 0 to xl, 0 and x1, 1 to xl, 1, and this is just how we name these things. All of these values are just inputs to the hash function. Or if we consider the discrete logarithm to be the one-way function that we want to use, then all of these things here are exponents. So each of these elements here is one exponent. So the signing key is pretty large. It consists of 2 times L elements, where each of these elements is, I don't know, 128 bits long. The verification key is just the same matrix or vector with two consisting of two subvectors, where each of these input values is just evaluated with the one-way function. So the first element of the verification key vector is f of x 1 0. The last element in that first row is f of x l 0. The first element in the second row is f of x 1 1. And the last element in the second row is f of x l 1. So, for the last couple of minutes, I want you to wake up and quickly try to follow what has been happening so far. So, signing key consists of input elements. L times two input elements, L elements in the first row, L elements in the second row, and all of them independently sampled. The verification key consists of the one-way function evaluated on each of these elements. So instead of the inputs, the verification key consists only of the outputs. Two rows of outputs where each input is evaluated individually. Now, if we have a message of L bits, so MI is just a bit, then the signature is just the vector of x1, m1 to xl, ml. Intuitively, what we do here is the signer has the signing key that consists of two rows of input elements. The verifier has all the output elements for these input elements. Now, when the signer wants to sign a message, the signer looks at the message, splits that message into its bits, and then for each bit, it selects from the signing key from which of the two rows it takes the input element. So the signature consists of the input elements, and for the first bit, we take either the first row or the second row, depending on whether the first bit of the message is 0 or 1. If the first bit of the message is 0, we select the input element from the first row. If the first message bit is 1, then we select the second row's element input. Okay. So, in summary, the sign algorithm chooses the pre-image or input for each, let's call it pre-image or input element, for each bit of M, and the verify algorithm checks if the pre-image works for the matching image or output in the verification key. That's the Lampard signature scheme. Why is this so interesting? Because first of all, we do have one-way functions that are post-quantum secure. So we have hash functions, we have pseudorandom generators, we have symmetric encryption schemes for which we are sure that they are secure against, against quantum adversaries. So the Lampard signature scheme is secure against quantum adversaries as long as we choose a suitable one-way function. The second thing that we see here is that we can build signatures actually from symmetric cryptography. So hash functions, pseudorandom generators, symmetric encryption, all of those things are symmetric cryptographic building blocks. So signatures can actually be built from symmetric cryptography. We will hear about all the problems of the Lampard signature scheme, for example, that verification keys are super long, that signatures are super long, and that we actually can't reuse the Lampard signature scheme. So once we have used it once, we can't use it a second time anymore. But there are solutions for all of that. And with that, I am very happy to have given this lecture to you today. Thank you very much for your attention, and we see each other next week.